Hello, everyone. Welcome to Frontside of the Podcast, episode 37. It's a special one. We've got a guest with us today. We'll introduce him. But first, I'm Brandon. I'm work here at the Frontside. Lydia, do you want to introduce yourself? And then Alex?
Sure. I'm Lydia Guarino, and I am a developer here at the Frontside. I've been here for a little over 6 months.
Alex. I'm also a developer at the Frontside, and I'm very, very excited for our guest today. I'm a big fan of the software that he's producing.
So let's jump right into it. Sam, do you want to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about yourself and your background? And it'd be fun to hear a little bit about how you get into programming before we dive into the stuff that we want to ask you about Ember CLI Mirage.
Sure. Thanks for having me, everyone. My name is Sam Selikoff. I'm a developer. I live in Brooklyn, New York right now. And I do mostly front-end work these days for TED Talks, the conference company. Yeah, so your first question, you wanted to know about how I kind of got into programming?
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
Cool. So let's see. It's 2016. So I've been programming for almost 4 years now, which is kind of crazy. I remember when I was starting out and you go on Twitter and you see people are like, I've been programming for 3 years. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so long, you know, like I'll be a pro by then. And it's like, wow, I still have a lot to learn. So I kind of had a career change, and I was in graduate school for economics, thought I wanted to be a professor, and academia just kind of, it wasn't really the right fit for me. So my first job out of graduate school was at a consultancy in Boston, and it wasn't related to programming at all. I hadn't had a background in programming. My brother and my dad are programmers, but I just kind of, I ended up studying business in school. But it seems like I couldn't really escape my destiny, I guess, now that I'm a programmer. So at the job, we were doing some data work. It was like a consulting firm, and we were running regressions on these big data sets from companies. And so one of the things that we did was use like SQL and SAS, like SAS, not the styling sheet stuff, but like this big database management tool that lets you, you know, basically do like regressions and all that kind of thing. And so I guess that's kind of where I cut my teeth on like data manipulation and just learning really just programming in the sense of like writing code to get something to do what you want it to do. And for me, that was like when it was all demystified, I guess. Like I had always kind of followed technology and been interested in it, but because I didn't study CS, I just figured like I missed the boat. But once I was here and my managers were like, we need this by tomorrow, do this. And I'm like, I don't know how to program. And they're like, just figure it out. And so it was kind of trial by fire, I guess. But I liked it. You know, every time I came to work, I was like, if I could just spend all day doing the programming stuff and not like read these like depositions or make these charts in Excel, then I would be happy. Like that would be my favorite part of the job. So I asked my brother, who is a programmer, like, is this possible? Like, can I learn this stuff even though I don't have a CS degree? And he was like, yeah, totally. So that's kind of how I got into it. And so for 8 months or so, I was just learning on the side. And then I was fortunate enough to find a job that let me kind of learn on the job there. I had enough, you know, I demonstrated that I knew enough about it that I could be, you know, I could contribute. And that's kind of how I broke into it, I guess.
That's cool that you could ease into your first break as a programmer. I think Everybody always searches for their first break, who's going to give me a chance. But you really got to let your company give you that over a period of time. It's pretty fortunate.
Totally. I think it's like anything, right? It's, in life, there's like this huge trade-off between time and money. And I think the boot camps and stuff are great, and they make a lot of sense for people who are in a different stage of their lives. And they, you know, they want to trade the money for a 3-month thing, and they can kind of level up really quick. But for me, I mean, I was used to living on like a $16,000 a year graduate stipend. So I wasn't going to enroll in a boot camp anytime soon. And 2012, actually, it's not super long ago, but they weren't quite as popular as they are now. So
would you do it today? Would you try boot camp today?
Today,
it was 4 years ago.
If it was 4 years ago, well, again, it's the money constraint. I mean, if you would pay for it,
I will not.
So
I like Mirage, but not that much.
So I again, it's like it just depends on where people are in life. But I think they're great. I mean, I absolutely love this industry. I love that people are driving forward this apprentice model where, you know, because you study school, you study in school for so long and you get out and everyone with their first job knows that they don't know anything. You know, even if you're in med school, the first time you start residency, I have friends who've done that and it's like they don't know anything. They've been studying like crazy for 4 years and it's the real learning takes place in the beginning of the job. So I'm a big believer in that. And I love that our industry is kind of making an example of that for really the rest of the working force. And the fact that if someone wants to get into programming, they can in 3 months, basically, I think it's amazing.
So then you got into Ember at some point.
Yes,
that
right.
So not a lot of people who are pretty brand new jump right into Ember. So how did that happen?
So I was at like a small financial company in Boston. And I was writing Perl scripts and learning about like our custom database format type, which was like, they call it data pipe. It was like these flat text files with like, I'm not even kidding right now, this text formatted with like these data pipes. And that's how it was read in. I mean, I love that everyone I work with, and it was a bunch of bright people, but they had the worst case of not invented here syndrome I've ever seen. They had their own email client that they wrote. We couldn't even use like a messenger because we didn't want to save, like send any data between our computers over like the cloud or whatever. So yeah, that was, but again, it was an amazing place to learn and it was really empowering. So basically I figured out pretty quickly. I learned a lot across the stack, you know, like at a shallow level, but I figured out pretty quickly that I really love building interfaces. You know, if someone came to me and said they wanted this thing to look like this and do this thing, just asking questions about that and then building the interface and just working on the design and, you know, adding the behavior with JavaScript, that was my favorite part of it. And it still is. So that's kind of how I got in JavaScript. So, you know, back in 2012, like Backbone was a big thing. And that's what I started with. And I started getting into the community there in Boston, and the folks at Boku had a JavaScript meetup, and then Dockyard was starting the Ember meetup. And my friend was at Startup Institute. He was actually in a similar path as I was. He was in the same grad program, and he also left. You know, I think a lot of people were just kind of seeing the writing on the wall, and you had this huge tech thing just moving along, and we were like, well, that looks a lot more interesting than academic economics. So he was in Startup Institute, and so he was learning like best practices. He was learning like Ruby on Rails and, you know, pretty solid JavaScript programming and about CI and all this stuff. So I was kind of learning some of the mainstream stuff vicariously through him while I was, you know, hacking around on Perl scripts and getting experience that way at work. And he said that a lot of the folks in the Rails community were talking about Ember, and some of the folks who had worked on Rails started working on Ember. So I went to the Dockyard meetup. He told me about it, and it was really early on in the meetup and in Ember's life, but everyone there was just super nice, super welcoming. Like after my first or second meetup, I was talking to Brian, the owner of Dockyard, and I was telling him about some of the D3 stuff I was playing around with, getting it to work with Ember components. And he was like, you should talk about that. And I was like, really? Like, I don't really know what I'm doing. He's like, whatever, just do it. And yeah, so it was just a really welcoming environment. I've always had such a good experience with the Ember community. And so that was kind of how I got started in Ember. And it's just been like that ever since.
Speaking of the Ember community, you have a really large OSS project that is getting a lot of eyeballs and a lot of pull requests and a lot of issues. And I was really curious what your experience was working on a project as big as Ember CLI Mirage is.
Yeah. That's a great question. And I've thought there's a meetup / conference talk kind of brewing in my head about this, because when I decided to open source it and really kind of pour myself into it and decide to maintain it in a way that would be useful to the community, I had heard at this point already, I had heard a lot of people talk about things like burnout or just talk about, you know, I guess like receiving abuse from other people online or harassment or just not being acknowledged or appreciated. And so when I went into it, I had heard a lot of people talk about this. So I think I kind of went in prepared. And well, I mean, first of all, I'll say again, like I have not had, obviously nothing's perfect, but the Ember community by and large and my experience with most of the JavaScript community has been overwhelmingly positive. When I went in, I think an important thing is to realize that you're doing something like this for free, and it's a passion project of mine. It's something I made that I thought was valuable, and I'm going to open source it for whoever wants to use it, but that doesn't make me responsible for other people's work or their problems, and it doesn't mean that I have an obligation to do anything for anybody else, especially if I'm clear about that when I put it out there. I'm clear that this is something that's working for us, that we get value from, and you're welcome to use it, and I will help as my time and my passion allows me to. But it doesn't. It's not a responsibility. It's a right I have to do this and be part of this community. So, you know, of course, there's always going to be people who feel entitled and who come say, "Why doesn't this work? Like, this sucks," or whatever. But it's fine. Like, you know, the world's not perfect. Those people exist, but you don't. I just made a decision not to let them. Not really affect or control my moods towards this. So there are times when I get busy with other things and I just pull back from it. And, you know, interestingly, the community is pretty amazing about stepping in and helping out during those times. And so even if there's people who are frustrated, like that's just a fact of life, I guess. And you can't please everyone. And as an open source maintainer or just as a human being, like that's not your job to please everybody. So
yeah, so I think that's a good answer, and I think there's a lot in managing a project of this size, but it's like also like having children. They don't come to you as, you know, angry teenagers. They start off as a little baby that requires very, you know, like constant maintenance, but it's mm-hmm. it starts a lot simpler than that and then kind of grows from there. And
definitely.
So like my memory of this was just over a year ago, right? A year and a couple months ago, I saw a thing called Ember CLI Pretenderify.
Right.
And I pulled up the tweet and it literally just says, "What?" I was just completely bowled over by how ambitious this idea was. I'd love to hear more about the genesis of this idea, because I think it was ambitious from the outset. How did you decide to layer something on, like, how did you get into the idea of layering something on top of Pretender? How did you get into that style of testing? I'm curious to hear about why. Mm-hmm. Why Pretenderify and then Mirage came about.
Right. So started basically at TED, we have, you know, just a handful of front-end engineers, and we were making a bunch of interfaces throughout our company, just serving different needs. And every time we just, you know, we're big into testing there. The guy who was there before me, one of my close friends and coworker, Ryan Toronto, he's been developing forever. He's one of the best developers I've ever worked with, and he is a huge advocate for testing. So, you know, just learning from him as we worked, like we wanted to make sure our interfaces were tested. And so we end up all of a sudden you have 6 or 8 Ember apps and you're doing this boilerplate. You know, we love Pretender. Trek did amazing work making an awesome DSL to make it easy to get going. But that boilerplate, you just start a new project. And when you open up the last project and copy everything you did, it starts kind of feeling a little gross, you know, it feels a little dirty. So the very first thing was just Pretenderify, which was just like an opinionated setup. And it had a directory where you could like put fixtures and then a directory where you could define mocks. And I think one of the big things that struck us was if we define our mocks, our actual routes in one place, but we can load different fixture files, then we can share the mock server in both development and in testing. Because what we were originally doing is like in a test, setting up your mock routes. But then, you know, a lot of times your mock routes are the same across lots of tests and across development. So that was kind of the first iteration, was just getting an opinionated setup to reduce the boilerplate. You know, at this point, add-ons were a thing, so it was just really easy to install it. And that way you don't have to think about how to wire it all up and to like start up and shut down your Pretender server for each test and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, that was kind of the origin. And then we kind of made like the database, basically. I had the idea that instead of using fixtures, if we made this kind of in-memory database object, then we really can just have a server separate, a definition separate from the data, just like you do in a real server. And it's funny because it wasn't like this idea was just sitting in my head. Like we just worked on it. You know, I worked on it a lot. Ted gave us these Learning Wednesdays that we could work on whatever we like passion projects every other Wednesday. And so that's what I was doing a lot of last year and, you know, in my spare time. And just as I developed it more and more, I realized that, you know, we're trying to mock out a server, and maybe the easiest way to do that is the easiest way to build an actual server, which is to separate these concerns so that it gives you more flexibility, so you reduce duplication and all this stuff. So it was always just a step-by-step thing, you know, building up the abstractions as they seemed necessary. I'm not a huge fan of like doing way too much abstraction, especially in tests. And like, I help some people. I do some mentoring with Ember, and I've taught a lot of people over the last couple of years and just worked with more junior developers. And the biggest problem I see is people running into abstractions too early. So in general, this is something I really try to avoid. I think it can get you in trouble. But again, as the needs came up, it just seemed like the best solution was to keep going down this path where you try to make the setup as concise as possible, and then all your tests are really just about setting up your data. So that's kind of how it grew over the last year.
I'm seeing a
pattern. Yeah, I really like go ahead, Alex.
Nope, you go ahead, please.
I was going to say, I really like watching kind of like your issue comments on Mirage. I've ended up finding a couple of them where the chain is sort of you posting comments back to yourself. It's like, where is this headed? Is this going to lead to like straight up models? What is happening here?
Yes.
And it's really interesting to just kind of see that you've outlined your own thought process on how you're going to keep expanding this project, like in a pretty public forum where everyone can see what's going on. I actually really love that because it means other people can jump in and, you know, pick up a thread and be like, oh, I could see how that might happen, and here's a suggestion on how to do it.
Totally. Like, I think it's because this thing just kind of got popular and it got more complex, but like it was really just me working on it. And I kind of wanted to tell everyone, like, everyone, listen, I'm not like a whatever, a 10X programmer. I'm just trying to do the best I can with what we're working with. And like, when people have problems, let's talk about it. So when I was like, I think we need an ORM in Mirage, and it's like, this sounds like a really bad idea. So like, I'm going to start opening issues about this and hope that like smarter people than me come in and give me feedback. And you do get some of that discussion. And I think I want to spend more time thinking about this, but I've thought a lot about just ways to get new contributors in, to break that barrier, whether it's Mirage or some other project, because, you know, that's what people told me, which had a big impact, which is like, oh, open source, you think it's this crazy thing, but it's just code that people have written, just like you, just like your coworkers. And it really is true.
I want to go back to something that you touched on earlier, which is you're pairing with junior devs or mentoring them, whatever it may be, mm-hmm. and you told them to avoid this extra layer of abstraction. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of ways I'm currently using Mirage is to avoid writing a backend for as long as I possibly can and get it right in Mirage first. I've been doing Ember and JavaScript for about a year, so is this the extra layer of abstraction that you're talking about that you want people to try to avoid? How do you recommend you use Mirage in that sense?
Yeah, so that's kind of how I do it as well, in the sense that if I start a new project, I like being able to iterate on my API needs and what the front end is actually going to look like without having to set up a back end until I'm pretty confident. I think that's fine. I think that's a great use of the tool. And the reality is, especially when we were kind of developing Mirage at the beginning, I asked a lot of people in the community to see like how they were doing mock APIs. And I tried to find, you know, I talked to people at conferences who are like iOS developers. And I asked, like, you know, if you're an iOS developer at Facebook, like, how do you hook up to the API and develop? Do you hook up to like Facebook's production API? Do you have to really pull down all of Facebook's code base and run the backend locally? And like, if so, how do you get mock data in there to develop your front end? Like, you need to be able to see how your front end renders and behaves in different scenarios based on the data that's coming up. So how do you do all that? And I basically just didn't see any answer that was satisfactory. So to me, again, eventually there might be something better that comes, but and Mirage might have served its purpose. But for now, I think it's an appropriate abstraction. It certainly has made my life and a lot of people's lives easier. So this is a case where, yeah, it's an abstraction, but it's a useful one. I think the biggest problem is jumping into an abstraction too early without really fully understanding the trade-offs. And I think it's something that's really easy for new developers to do, especially me at the beginning, just because it's fun to write abstractions. It's fun to think like that and to see how you could reduce duplication. But, you know, Sandy Metz makes this great point, which is that duplication is a lot cheaper than the wrong abstraction. Mm-hmm. And when you find yourself with a bad abstraction, the best way forward is to undo that. So I think that's just a general lesson. And I was just making and I think it's fine. So I think what you're doing, it sounds fine. It's just the general rule is abstractions come with a cost. And so you really just need to be aware of the trade-offs there.
Go ahead, Lydia.
I was going to say that Mirage has become, you know, pretty critical to the way that we operate at the front side because we're a consultancy, which means, you know, we don't always have varying levels of control of what the back end is doing. Some of our clients give us full control. Some of them give us absolutely no control.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to be able to keep moving forward, Mirage has actually become this like missing piece that I think maybe we didn't even know we were missing until
That's so
we had
awesome.
It available to us. Yeah, I mean, we're using it on all of our current projects right now, and even on some of our open source projects as well. But it's really, you know, helped us in the case where, you know, sometimes the client's backend is less stable, so the API might be changing rapidly, and we can, you know, stick Mirage in there and give ourselves a stable place to develop. Without worrying about the implications of exactly what they're doing. And then we can just, you know, check in periodically and make sure that our development process is at least going moderately in parallel with what they're doing.
Right.
So we actually use it in development mode almost as much as we use it in test mode. Mm-hmm. So that's been really interesting. I think we started, Alex, the first time we started playing with it was on Ember Impagination, right? That was like 6 months ago.
That is right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now it's just, we've just stuck it in everything.
So, yeah.
That's really great to hear. I'm glad.
I'd like to drive that line of questioning down a little even further, because this is actually I was surprised at the fact that this was a contentious topic, and there are people that are not invited to come argue with us that would like to argue this. And so my feeling currently, and obviously opinions and libraries, all this stuff is subject to change, but my opinion currently is that has produced a lot of good results for us. This ability. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing an application on the side right now where I haven't written the backend yet, and mm-hmm. I'm going to write the backend to, I'm writing basically the spec for the backend as I build the front end out. And that style of development has been really freeing for me.
Right.
The cost of this abstraction feels really good because that shearing layer at the API, instead of being bound to a backend that I have to change every time I make a change the desire of what I want on the front end, I keep changing the fake one in Mirage until I land on something that I want. And then eventually I make my way where you kind of like bust the barrier down and you can have this fully integrated application except for in testing. But at the very beginning stages of development, I'm finding that to be a really freeing way of development. And I know there are people that would argue against it. And I'm curious as to whether that's something that you do or that's whether that's like an unintended side effect of what you've done with Mirage.
No, that's exactly what I do. And again, it all came out of real needs that we had and solutions to actual problems. So the first thing I would say is if you don't feel a need for a need to mock your API, like for example, if you're just a single person building a new app and you're super proficient in Rails and that's what your backend is, and like you never felt a need to have to do a mock in JavaScript, then by all means, like there's no reason to add that complexity. But at the same time, like you guys said, there's times where, you know, you don't have access to the back end, or maybe, you know, on our team, we have maybe a newer JavaScript developer come on and they want to, you know, check out a project and start running it. And they don't want to have to install, like maybe they've never had a database installed on their computer or Ruby at all, or they don't know anything about Rails. And this way they can just Git clone and Ember serve and start developing and even testing. So I think the pushback comes from the fact that, so first of all, it is more abstract. Of course, there's a layer of abstraction there. Although by using Ember, we already have the separation, right? And there's a boundary in the middle between our clients and our servers. So that already it, there's is some of that complexity already there. I think some of the other pushback would be that, well, now you have a situation where you can have tests that are based on this mock server and that your test can pass, but your mock server could actually fall out of sync with the backend, the real backend. So you could have tests that pass, but your app actually doesn't work because you're using this mock server.
Yep.
And so that was a big concern at the beginning. And of course, this is not just Mirage. This is anyone doing testing with mocks, whether it's, you know, mock jacks or Pretender or anything. And Sandy Metz also talks about this in her book, Practical Object-Oriented Design in Ruby. And she says, when you use a mock, of course, this is not even just particular to Mirage or API mocking. This is mocking in general. If you have a test that uses a mock, what can happen is the interface of that mock can fall out of sync with the interface of the actual object it's mocking. So as soon as you make a mock, which is a useful thing to do in testing oftentimes, you run this risk of the mock falling out of sync with the real thing, and then your test giving you a false positive. So Sandy describes the solution to this is to have an interface test that says as soon as you mock something out, you create an interface test, and you include that in both the original object and the mock. And so those tests will pass as long as, let's say you're mocking out a person, and a person has a person.greeting method. Person.greeting, so person has to respond to greeting, and then you make a mock person so you can use it in your tests. That mock also has to respond to greeting as well. So you have an interface test that says all person-like objects respond to greeting. And then you run that test for both the original and for the mock object. And so now you can be confident that your real tests are passing and that it's not a false positive. And if you were to ever change the person's interface, say to person.salutation, well, now the interface test would fail because person no longer responds to greeting. And so that would tell you that your mock is no longer representative of the actual thing. And you would go ahead and update the mock, then the test would fail, and then you'd update the test or the actual code. And so this is kind of, I think that's the high level overview. And so basically we have a mock and we have the real thing, right? Like you were saying, Brandon, like the interface of our API, that's really the thing that we're stubbing out. And it's true that the mock can fall out of sync. Now there's been some work, there's a Ruby library called Pact, which is that you can actually create as a build artifact this contract file that talks about, it basically is a way, as an executable way to test that your mock server and your real server all do the same thing against these endpoints. And that's something I've thought about before and would be super interested in having Mirage support. And so 6 months ago, this is when I first started thinking about this stuff, and I was like, oh, we should really do this. Otherwise, people will have like failing tests and they'll have broken apps. Now, it turns out that it just hasn't been as big of a problem as I thought it might be. And I think it's because once you do get that API set, you know, you don't make a lot of breaking changes to your API for a variety of reasons, right? That just makes it, I mean, especially the more conventional our APIs get, like the less likely it is they're going to change in a way that's going to really break and make our Mirage mock servers or even your stubs and your Pretender stubs and your tests like wrong. So I guess that would be my response is that, yeah, there's a trade-off, of course. There's a trade-off just like when you mock anything, you run this risk. But especially with things like APIs that we're understanding them better these days, like they're more conventional, especially with things like JSON API, we don't have to worry about it. And so that's the negative. But the positive is, you know, like you were saying, the speed and flexibility you get, you don't have to have a server running. You can have more control over your tests. They're faster, all these other things. So that's kind of where I fall on it.
I really love this idea of interface testing. I hadn't heard it before, but I thought about it a lot for Mirage. And mm-hmm. I always stopped thinking about it when I realized comparing JSON payloads doesn't really make much sense. It's not the right test. Mm-hmm. But saying that person responds to greeting, like that small removal from your JSON payload itself really seems like that missing piece.
Mm-hmm. So you might be interested in this article called Contract Driven Design. I think that's what it's called, by Martin Fowler. And it's basically this idea that really the API should be driven by the needs of the client. And that's one thing that I really love about GraphQL and Falcor is that they're saying our interface And the actual business value that our interface delivers and the way that our actual users use our interface, that should drive basically everything from the top down. And so when you decide to expose a resource from your server, when you decide how things are sideloaded or included or formatted, all of this should be driven by the client, because that's where the business value is ultimately delivered. And so that's kind of his take on it. And I really like how Mirage kind of fit in with that, where you get to think about your UI, and you don't have to worry about all these other details. You don't care about what the database structure is. You're just figuring out the UI. And I personally find that a really nice way to develop. And then the Ruby library is called Pact. And that's the idea that when we build an Ember application, what we're really saying is, given a server that responds to a GET request to / contacts, then my Ember app will render this page looking like this. And so that boundary is actually what the pact is that I have a server that responds to GET contacts and returns data that looks like this. So you can write an automated test for that. You can say, given I have 3 contacts in my server, when I make a GET request to / contacts, then I get a payload that looks like this. And you can run that against a Mirage server. You can run that against an actual Ruby server or whatever your server is. And so people are doing that today. People are doing it not with Mirage, at least not that I know of. But you know, people who work in like a service-oriented architecture environment with lots of, let's say, Rails apps talking to each other, they have the same issue. And you know, it's interesting because people come down and they say, well, we don't want a mock server, and you really should, because you run into this risk of having things fall out of sync. But if you talk to somebody at a conference who works at Netflix or at Amazon, you know, a request to any one of those services, to one of their web pages, can go through sometimes like 100 services. I heard that before, something like the Amazon homepage. Eventually that goes through like dozens of services. So it's at that level, and at TED, we don't have dozens of services, but we do have several. And at that level, it's unrealistic to get a test environment set up where you're actually doing a true end-to-end test in a way that you have control over the data for everything, right? So in that situation, it becomes really important to test at the boundaries. And so that's why I think if we can get to a point where we make it easier to test at the boundaries and have more confidence in the boundaries, that's the solution that I would like to see.
I think as Mirage comes earlier in development processes, especially for larger enterprise applications, which I think are starting to use Mirage, we're going to see that call for an interface become a lot more important. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw PRs creeping up in the future, very close in the future.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, but so far what we've done, and our style, this style of development for us predates Mirage by a wide margin, which is why it was so exciting when we saw it, because we felt this pain very, very acutely, because we started testing Ember apps when the exercise of doing so was like a week-long exercise. And it included creating all these really crystalline fixtures that required changes. So if somebody adds a model attribute, you basically lost a day of work to go edit a bunch of manual fixtures. So it's stuff. So feeling that pain so acutely and seeing Mirage come along was a huge, huge deal for us. And so and it enables more people to participate in that style of development. And what we were trying to explain to people would say, why aren't you writing everything in Selenium tests? And it's like, well, our application is client side. Our tests are robust. We're very confident in this suite that takes less than a minute to run and runs and exercises the application very well. And we have server-side logic, and that is tested very well. And then all you have left is to test the contract between those two things. And as you said earlier, it changes infrequently enough that actually has not created a huge pain point for the people we've worked with in the past. Now, eventually, like Alex said, that will change as services – as people involve more and more services, you're going to want to test those contracts. And
definitely.
But our experience was that can come later, that this is the most important problem to solve right now, is making this style of internal, like front-end, end-to-end testing. And I really, really like the, not even analogy, just the direct analog to iOS apps. Like we're essentially building an iOS app. How do they do that?
Right, exactly. And it's so funny because I really wanted to know because I was like, I don't want to build like a mock server framework in JavaScript if I don't have to. Like, I just want to get back to working on my app, you know? Like, this, how is this not a solved problem? And it just, I don't know. It seemed like from the research I did, like, maybe the iOS community just isn't as into testing as like the Ruby and JavaScript communities are. I mean, I couldn't really, I don't know. I didn't really find a satisfactory answer. And I think what you said is exactly right, is that, yeah, we acknowledge that there's a cost and a boundary there, but the fact is that the benefits you gain from being able to move faster in the front end, that they just outweigh it. So,
so my experience working with Mirage is it's beta software and it has not landed on its set of abstractions fully yet. And it's clear, and I loved how Lydia said earlier that it's clear that you're kind of searching for this in a public way. And it even seems in flux right now, where I gave a talk about an introductory talk about, hey, this is what O2 beta is like compared to what it used to be. And then I read a post that you wrote. It was kind of RFC style about here's the plans, the current plans for additional changes to the programming model. And it's potentially becoming more complex, at least internally. And you can see that that buys you some things. Like, I was able to drop in a JSON API adapter and have JSON API spitting out in one line of code, which is really great. Are there plans to use that layer of abstraction to do additional things like maybe GraphQL support or anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, first is, I think it's exactly as you said, is if we can make, I'm okay with Mirage becoming more complicated and abstract if it means that people's mock code doesn't have to be, can become less complex. So I think it's good. Like, someone PR'd the include query param for JSON API serializer Mirage. And like, I just started a new app today at work and it's just awesome because you don't have to do anything. You just like, oh, I want to include it, and like your Mirage server will return it. Just like JSON API resources gem for Rails will just work. So I think that's great. The big change you're referring to is the collection API. So when we first, I realized we needed something like an ORM in Mirage. Well, we needed an ORM basically, because setting up relationships, you know, within factories, and also doing things like having a JSON API serializer that knows how to include related resources, all that, you have to have the relationship information somewhere. But yeah, we're definitely, it's still being tested out. Although I'm pretty happy with where things are right now. One thing that we realized was that having like a model and a collection, the collection actually, it's interesting because if you're familiar with Rails, you know, if you do like author.posts, you get something like a collection proxy. And this is like something that represents an array, and it's aware of the records in the database, but you know, they're hydrated, like they're models that are hydrated, but this collection has other methods on it, collection.where, collection.update, things like this. And it's important for it to be this collection object so that when it gets serialized, like the serializer knows I'm dealing with a collection of posts, let's say. And so we started with something similar in Mirage, where you, if you do author.post, you get a collection. But the interesting thing is in JavaScript, JavaScript developers are really used to working with arrays, and they're used to sorting them and filtering them and mapping them. And they like to use Lodash to do that, and they like to use Ramda to do that. So we don't really have the opportunity in JavaScript to just say, oh, here's a collection. Like, if you want to filter it, you use collection.where. Because people are going to be, you know, and understandably so, people are going to say, no, I want to use, like, Lodash here. So that was what that issue was about. But I think with a few more of those, I think there's just a few more edge cases, but I think we're pretty happy with where things are. So I definitely want to get like a 1.0 out. I know it's been a long time and a lot of people are using Mirage, and like, it's basically, you know, people are using it. So it should be a 1.0 more or less. But I just, it's my first real big project like this. And I just didn't want to, I just felt like I just wanted to make sure the API was something that could be around for a little bit. So yeah, I think we'll get there soon.
Yeah. That's a great answer.
Yeah. I think something that got it as far as it did is this amazing documentation that you've done with the website. Do you think that it would have gotten this far without it? Could you have put this in a README and made it more concise? Or is there a certain point where you need to take an add-on or an application and make a web application for its documentation? Where is that line?
It's, for me, it's just a personal thing. Like, I like going to her project, and if I see a website that's maintained and updated and clear, and there's been a lot of thought put into the writing, and you know, that tells me that I can have confidence in the project. So I wanted to make sure people knew that I was invested in this and having it be successful. And so for me, the website was just, and it's just fun for me. Like I like design and building things like that. So I wanted to do that from the beginning. So
is there a rule you have about it? Cause it's clearly versioned and it's up to date with the betas, which I've literally never seen before. So I'm really curious to know, is that something you built from scratch yourself, or is that something like, is there something you pulled off the shelf to help you with it? And do you have policies around like something doesn't ship if it's not documented? Like how do you decide on that stuff?
Yeah. So that stuff is all manual now. I mean, it's not too much work. It really, it's just making sure I remember it. But, I looked at readthedocs.org or whatever, and some different things like that. And none of them kind of checked off all the boxes. So it's just a Jekyll site. It's just a site I made. And I just figured out some kind of hacky way to have like a data file. Cause Jekyll, you can have data files where you specify the navs, and that gives me like the version doc. So it's not right now, it's manual. I would love for it to be automatic. And also I need to get API docs in there. The API docs are there, but they're all handwritten. I'd love to have it pull from the comments in the code and like add JS doc. This is just all stuff that I'd like to eventually do. But no, it's just kind of something that, again, from the beginning, I told myself that I wanted it to be, I'd rather, if I had the opportunity to ship two features over the next couple of weeks, or to ship one feature and make sure that everybody who's interested in using this, not just the people who want to go source code diving, but everyone can do so, I would choose the latter every time. So that's just a decision that I've made that I think that's my philosophy about products as well. About, you know, when other product designers or developers have done that, I agree with that. I think you want to complete the whole experience end to end before you release something. You still want to do it incrementally, and you still want to be iterative about it and not get too in the weeds for too long. But I would rather do less and do a better job of it than do more in the same time frame. I guess that's just kind of part of what I believe about good software development. So
I think that'll make better software every time. Yeah. Every time you make that decision.
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left, and I know that Mirage is not like the only thing that you work on. We're obviously very excited about Mirage because it's something we use in the office all the time. But I'd love to hear a little bit about some of the other things that are on your plate right now, and kind of some other things to look forward to in the future.
Yeah. Well, Mirage is definitely the main open source thing that I do. I help a little bit out with the Ember CLI deploy stuff, because at TED we have set up our own kind of Ember CLI deploy suite that works with the Rails backend and gives you like rollback and version deploys and all that kind of stuff. But I honestly don't help out with that as much, just because I do focus my open source time on Mirage. And of course, there's a million things I'd love to see in Mirage. I'd love to see a tab to the Ember Inspector that shows you your Mirage server and shows you your data. Mm-hmm. And maybe like a mock network tab that shows you the like just easier
that
way
would
to
be
log
amazing.
It. Yeah, all that stuff would be incredible. But yeah, other than that, I did the guy that I mentioned that we did testing with, Ryan Toronto, and I, he's a coworker of mine, a friend of mine at TED. We are starting some a video site called Ember Map, and it came from a need we had of just wanting an easy way. Basically, so I think this is true for the community at large, or the JavaScript programming community at large, but also for Ember. There's a ton of awesome resources out there, but a lot of them are geared towards beginners, and that's great. It's awesome. But at the same time, when you're on a team and you've run into some more of these intermediate problems, there's not really a course on lynda.com or Pluralsight that you can really show your coworker, right? Most of the courses there are going to be like getting warmed up with Ember. So the idea we had is to start making some kind of bite-sized videos to point out maybe problems we were seeing in code, or just ways that your team can enforce kind of consistent, high quality principles across your apps. And so this is a side project that I've been spending some time on, and it's still kind of in the validation phase. We just put up a landing page at embermap.com, but yeah, that's something we're hoping to have. We're hoping to have the videos ready for EmberConf so that people can just check them out and we can talk about them. And we also are just interested in talking to teams and seeing what their needs are, you know, seeing what problems people face that are similar to ours, that are different from ours. And if they had a resource that, you know, maybe they could just show their teams, like, okay, this is a good way to do acceptance testing. And you can just watch these videos, and that way it just saves you that having to explain them or having to go search blog posts that might not be updated. Like, I know I have blog posts that are not updated. Like, it's just hard. So, yeah, that's kind of something else I've been focusing a lot of my time on lately.
Is this something you do for training, Sam?
So I've done, no, not yet. This is brand new. And the idea would just be, really, we just want to validate whether or not we can make a video tutoring site and maybe some other kind of materials for teams that is viable and that's sustainable. I do like some mentoring and training I've done on the side, but this would just be about the content on the website. So I think the key thing here is that, again, like I've really wanted to do some video courses before. Like, I thought about going to Pluralsight or something and trying to set up a class there. But again, like, I think if you're on a team, especially on an Ember team, if I wrote a book or made a course on Ember in 6 months or in a year, like, there'd be a lot that would be out of date. And it's great. I think those courses are great. But the idea, we want to see if this is practical for us to have these kinds of bite-sized videos that are high enough level that we can keep them up to date if things change. So, for example, maybe you have a video on acceptance testing and you break it up into 3 or 4 pieces that are, you know, 4 to 5 minutes. One of them talks about running your test server and, like, how does it start up your test. The next one is, like, writing a test and, like, using the test helpers. And if the test helpers change, like, actually right now, you know, Robert Jackson's been talking about the grand testing unification or whatever, and so we might see some changes to the API there soon. We could re-record that, but that way your team would always have access to kind of this up-to-date, very targeted material that you can share with each other. You can make sure that you're always doing things as kind of current best practices. And then importantly, if you bring on somebody new onto the team, you still have this resource and you can share it with them. So that was kind of a need that came from our work and the teams that we worked with. And so we want to see if it's a problem for others.
I really like that idea. And my experience is similar, that things kind of go out of date pretty quickly. And so content that you can update more frequently and more iteratively than that. And Ember has a stronger sort of team orientedness than a lot of other things, where if you can get a team to all share something like that, you get to level up a bunch of people working together at once, which is pretty cool.
Exactly. That's you're exactly right. So I think the idea is, again, like, you have courses, places like Lynda and Pluralsight, which are amazing. And I use those to learn, and I learned a ton. And, like, I'm so thankful for those sites. But being an Ember developer on a team of Ember developers, like, there's unique things that we know that are different than those kind of mass consumption sites can offer. So I think the things that, if I were to tell a team and I were talking to them about whether or not they should start using Ember, to really get the benefits of Ember, like, there are certain things you have to know. And, like, one of them is, you know, like, believing in conventions and making sure that we're doing things conventionally. And again, like, we've seen the success at TED. We have now, like, I don't know, over a dozen Ember apps. And sometimes, you know, Ryan will be at a conference and I won't be there, and he'll be able to jump into 2 or 3 of my different front ends that are being used and work on them just as if they were his apps. Because once you get those conventions down, then you feel right at home. So I think, and also, if you want to go into the tests and see how they're written, and they're written in a similar fashion, or, again, this was kind of another motivation behind Mirage, like, I want to be able to open your app, just open your Mirage folder and, like, know what the API endpoints are expected, how data flows through the app, all of these kinds of things. The more that you get your teammates on board with the same ways of doing things, the more synergy your team's going to have, and the better Ember will be for, you know, helping you all accomplish your goals. So that's kind of the value proposition, I guess.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Sam, I think that's a great way and place to end it. And I very much thank you for your time. We had to really restrain ourselves from fanboying and fangirling all over. we really, really like the work that you've done. And it's bringing around the future of web development that we envision as well at the front side. And thank you for all the work that you do in this. And please think of us and as part of the community of people that want to help as in the way all the ways that we can. So
awesome. That's really humbling. I really appreciate all the kind words, and I'm just so glad that people find it useful. That's awesome.
All right. Well, thanks again for your time, and I can't wait to have people's feedback about this. Any things that you wish that we'd ask Sam, and any other questions that you might have, hit us up at the front side on Twitter, and we'll see everybody next time. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.